Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Shanti, Shanti, Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Okay, page 24. Plurality of the individual selves. The jivas, which are eternal entities, are infinite in number. They are not only different from one individual to another, but also distinct from Brahman, the supreme self. Right, because have you established that? Because you might say, okay, they're different, but then they're common with Brahman. Mm-hmm. Or they're different from Brahman, but they're all themselves one, right? So you have to establish both. Mm. Jiva is Anu. Jiva is described in the Shastras to be infinitesimal, or Anu. The monadic characteristic of Jiva is its natural monadic. Monadic? Any idea of monadic? Monadic is its natural form. That is, it is not caused or conditioned by any physical limitations. Ishwara is vibhu, or all-pervasive, but he is described as infinitesimal in the inner recesses of the heart. Here the anuttva of Paramatma is not his natural character, but is caused by physical limitation, aupadika. No such limitation is mentioned in respect of jivatma. Therefore, anuttva of jiva is its natural state. Right? So the jiva is very small, right? So then, and the Bhagavan is unlimited, right? But at the same time, as the Bhagavan comes into the heart of the living entity, is very small, right? So that means he's smaller than the smallest. The smallest means us. When it says smaller than the smallest means us, so that he's smaller than that. But that's not his natural characteristic. That's because that's how big we are, or because in the body, that's the limitation. So therefore, he takes that size. Right? So that's not his natural form. But being small is not mentioned as something the jiva is limited by time and space. No, he's just, that's how big he is. Right? Is that what I'm saying? You get something on monadic?
One cell.
The one-celled character of jiva is its natural form, right?
Okay. Monadic. Without
I see, the adjective monadic. Without?
No, monad is one cell.
One cell. Oh, I see. So monadic means like one-celled nature. Okay, so very small. Okay.
Biological term.
Okay. Really small. While describing jiva as infinitesimal, the Upanishads uses the expression that jiva is ananta, or infinite. In another place, jiva is described as nitya and sarvagata, that is, it is eternal and pervades everywhere. This gives the impression that jiva is vibhu, or all-pervasive. But the Vishishtadvaita points out that such description of jiva as pervading everywhere are to be understood to mean that jiva as a spiritual entity could enter into any material substance without obstruction, right? Because he's very small. Even though jiva is not all-pervasive, its attributive jnana is infinite and all-pervasive like the light of the sun. The infinite character, anantya, applies not to jiva but to its attribute of knowledge. This means that jiva is anu, whereas its knowledge is capable of becoming infinite. In the state of mukti, when the jiva is totally free from karma, it becomes omniscient. Mm-hmm. Right? There would be another element, but it generally is described differently. It means ananta, or infinite, is also just that means that there's infinite, unlimited living entities pervading everywhere. It means everywhere in the whole, this whole material creation, there's just jivas. Right? So there's as many jivas as there are atoms. So that means basically they're everywhere. Right? So that would be another aspect. But here in Vishishta Dvaita, it's just sticking to the individual jiva, because that's how they will say, because it's not necessarily describing the plural element.
Okay. Why do they become omniscient when
thinking? Because because then they can see all things. There's no modes of nature blocking their vision, right? So they're able to perceive all the different things. But that doesn't mean omniscient like the Supreme Lord's omniscience. It just means on that Brahman level, they're basically omniscient, you know, like that.
It can be difficult for us to comprehend how there can be more jivas as compared to atoms.
No, as many.
As many.
Not more.
Okay.
Don't worry. There's not more.
Same.
They're same.
Exactly. Okay.
I don't know if
still.
You have to count, but there's one more jiva. Right.
But yeah. Still. Because how... You know, they're not... I mean, the rock is not... necessarily conscious, right?
How do you know?
I don't know. I said necessarily.
Have you checked?
That's hello? That's the point. How long do you have to check to be sure?
With rocks, you just poke them with a pin.
Oh, okay.
If they move, they're alive, and if they don't move, then they're not.
Which Upanishad is?
I'm not sure. It's a standard way of checking.
Okay. Good to know. I still have the same question. What are they... what are they in? I'm
floating
jiva.
Around.
Yeah, just floating around.
Means you have the air, means it's full of these monadic living entities.
True, yeah.
Yeah? Yeah? So, I mean, there's a lot of those. Mm.
But that's a cell. That's still several atoms.
Yes.
Isn't that the basic idea of atom is different to the modern idea of atom also?
Yeah. Well, atom is the smallest particle of matter. So, therefore, if there's something, it's not made up of a bunch of, it's the one. It would be just a single atom. Right? Then you put so many of those together, then you end up with your different things. Mm-hmm. It's just like before, what they call a molecule, now they call an atom. Then they found the atom was smaller. And then there was nothing smaller, so then the molecule was made of atoms. Now they find the atoms are made up of so many things. So the Vedic, then that would be understood that that's a combination, and then there's the singular.
Okay. So it's not a major point?
No, like that. Because otherwise they're just basically in everything. Because the point is for you, this important is what are you conscious of and control of? Mm-hmm. Right? So that's the...
Yeah.
Yes.
Can it also be relevant so that we understand like harming living entities every time we move or breathe in?
Yeah, well, that's what Manu mentions. You know, by walking, by sweeping, by breathing, by sweeping, by any running water, any of these kind of things, grinding, like that.
They're not free. They're always implicated. So
yeah.
The only way to become free is to actually become conscious.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, in other words, the whole point, there's a lot.
Check. Got it.
So in other words, he's infinitesimal, but then the infinite or ananta is because even though he's of that size, his ability of knowledge is infinite, because he can know the infinite, right? And at the same time, he's omniscient, is that when he's on the liberated platform, free from the modes, there's no modes to get in the way of his understanding, so in that way he can pervade anything. It's not necessarily he's pervading everything at once, but it means that he could pervade whatever he wants to. Right, even that was that thing given to by the Gandharva, was offered to Arjuna, the ability to see into anything. you know, understand anything like that. But Arjuna wasn't so interested. Right. Otherwise, it drives him nuts.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
Jiva and Brahman. Ishwara and Jiva are two spiritual entities, which are absolutely real and also distinct. The Svetasvatara Upanishad says there are two: the one knowing, the other not knowing, both unborn. One a ruler, the other not a ruler. The Mundaka Upanishad describes Jiva as one caught up in bondage, whereas Ishwara is free from it. The Antaryami Brahmana of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad refers to as Brahman as the indweller of Jivatma. The Vedanta Sutra states categorically that Brahman is different from Jiva, which is subject to karma. Right? The Jiva is subject to karma, Brahman is not. The scriptural texts also speak of non-difference between Brahman and Jiva. Thus says the Chandogya Upanishad, "Thou art that, Tattvamasi." The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad equally asserts the identity. This self is Brahman. Ayam Atma Brahma. How do we account for such texts which emphasize non-difference or identity of Brahman and Jiva? Ramanuja does not accept the Beda-Beda theory because, according to him, it would amount to the admission of the defects of Jiva in Brahman. Nor does he subscribe either to the view of the dualist, emphasizing only difference, or that of monist, upholding only non-difference, because in either case, the validity of all the Upanishadic texts cannot be maintained. Then Ramanuja resorts to a sutra which acknowledges the two conflicting views about Jiva and Brahman as different, nana, and also non-different, anyata, cha, and uses the expression amsa to explain the relation of Jiva and Brahma, Brahman. Vedanta Sutra 11.11.342. You can't have it's probably 2.342. Okay, you can't have 11. Amso nanan vyap de shat anyata cha. While commenting on this sutra, Ramanuja states that Jiva is to be accepted as an integral part, amsa, of Brahman, in order to account for its non-difference as well as difference from Brahman. Right? Mm-hmm. So at the same time, we accept that because the non-difference element is there. It is, but he's trying to avoid the Beda-Beda theory, because if by doing that, then he would say then that there's, you know, he's somehow saying that would say that there's defects of Jiva and Brahman, because he becomes control. So if there's a non-difference, then he can be covered, but Brahman can't. So there has to be more of a difference. So he's saying he's a part, an umsa of Brahman, right? Which also we'll agree with, but at the same time as their quality or state. You see, is that they're, for what how they're preaching and all that, then their system works, right? Because it brings out an aspect of Godhead, like that. Does that make sense? But sometimes we would bring out a different one of that, meaning the Lord is Satchitananda and the Jiva is Satchitananda. So therefore, in that way, in quality, they're one. But in quantity, they're not. You know, like the drop of ocean water and the ocean, they're made of they have the same chemical analysis. But one's unlimited and one's onward. Right? Does that make sense? So therefore, then there's a non-difference in difference. So, yeah. Okay. By adopting the metaphysical category of substance and attribute and the concept of apritak siddhi, Ramanuja explains the relation of Jiva to Brahman. From ontological standpoint, Ramanuja explains the relation of Jiva to Brahman on the basis of the concept of body-soul relation, sharira-shariri-bhava. Brahman, as the material cause of the universe and ground of all existence, is the adhara, and the jivas are described as adheya, that which depends on it for its existence. Like the adhara shakti is accommodating, and the adheya means that they're dependent upon that adhara for their existence. Because right? They were expanded anyway from the Lord's internal potency. Brahman as the immanent spirit and the inner controller of the universe of chit and achit is the Niyanta, and Jiva is the Niyamya, one which is controlled by Ishvara. The controller and the controlled. From the ethical and religious standpoint, Jiva is described as Seisha, as one who serves God, and God is Seishin, the master of all. This threefold relationship is described as Sharira Shariri Sambandha, or the relationship of the body to the soul. Thus, Jiva is an integral part, amsa, or mode, prakara, of Brahman. It is therefore distinct but inseparable from it. Right? Because you have to have the inseparable. Distinct but inseparable. Right? Because if the distinction is not there, then means all the jivas themselves would make up Brahman, because something like that. If you're part of Brahman, then if you take all the jivas, then there is no Brahman. Right? Then you have to put them all back. You know, so you have to make that distinction that there's Ishvara and the Jiva, right? So they're inseparable, but at the same time is they are different. Okay. Abhideya. Eligibility of Jiva for moksha. While considering the basic nature of moksha, two basic questions arise. First, is there a scope at all for the soul to escape from bondage? Secondly, if there is, would all souls be eligible for moksha? The first question arises because of the accepted fact that souls are caught up in the continuous cycle of birth and death. Karma, which causes bondage to the soul, is beginningless, and it flows continuously like the stream of a river. If Jiva is caught up in such a constant stream of births and deaths, would there be any scope for his escape from it? There is a view according to which karma, unless it is experienced, does not cease to have its influence on the individual even after millions of kalpas. How then can Jiva escape from bondage? The only problem is that unless karma is experienced, point is if karma has to be experienced to become free from it, then you would just need a few moments to kind of like figure out this is not good. It is no doubt that Jiva is passing through the cycle of karma vidya. Nevertheless, the stage arises in this long march when good karma becomes ripe to provide an opportunity for the individual and escape from bondage. Oh, I see. It means if you're taking the... Now I get what they're talking about here. They're talking about... It means you do an activity, you become implicated, but in doing that, you're doing so many other activities. So at every moment, you're doing an activity that you need to get the result from. So unless you've gone through it and it's finished, how will you get out? So because there's constantly going on activities, how will you actually get away from them? Yeah. Right? Because even though you finish this karma, still the next one is there. So moment to moment, that there's always there. So there's a view that therefore the jiva can never get out. Right? That's why the question comes up. Is there a scope to escape, and would everybody be eligible? Right? Mm-hmm. So that he's dealing with that is that in the cycle of karma, it's going on. Like it says, the flowing of rivers, it's just constant. Right? Everything is moving, everything is involved. But he's saying here is that there's a time when good karma becomes ripe, then it's a good chance to escape. Right? Because then the prominence is that, then the mode of goodness one would escape from that. Mm-hmm. Right? So this would also deal with, is everybody eligible? Right? Mm-hmm. As a result of the meritorious deeds performed in earlier births, the individual comes into contact with a man of spiritual wisdom. Through their influence, he earns further merit by doing good deeds and thereby becomes the object of grace of Ishvara. As a result of this, he becomes an aspirant for moksha, mumukshu, and thereafter he undertakes brahmopasana, or meditation on Brahman, which is the means to moksha. The upasana helps to get rid of the past karma as well as the karma of the future. Once the jiva becomes freed from karma, it achieves moksha. Mm-hmm. So when one is performing good activities under the influence of here, a person of spiritual wisdom, then that brings the grace of the Lord, and that brings the desire to get out of the material world. Right? Does that make sense? So we see is that therefore achieves moksha. But as we mentioned before, that's still on the material platform, because just getting out of the material world isn't what's special. Right? It's getting into the spiritual world. Right? That's the actual point. Because otherwise you get out of here, then where do you go? You know, it's like, you know, you're in some place you don't like, so you leave that place, but then you're out on the street. Now what? Right? You know.
It's indefinable.
Yes. Indefinable. So you sit on a bench and absorb yourself in the indefinability-ness of it.
The bench of no bench.
The bench of no bench. Okay.
Is this the view of Ramanuja? That's Ramanuja's view?
Yes.
So they talk about moksha?
No, it mentioned about this is how he achieves moksha. But he's mentioning there is by the grace of Ishwara. But then the thing is, then he becomes an aspirant for moksha and this and that. So it's still by the Lord's grace that he's developed that. That the living entity would even want something other than just being caught up in the cycle of birth and death means it's still the Lord's grace, because the Lord is the one who grants moksha. So even the interest in that would still be given by the Lord. But the point is unless one understands that the personality of Godhead, he is Mukunda, then it becomes offensive. Somebody's giving you something, but you don't recognize them. You know what I'm saying? You're inheriting something, you know, but you don't recognize the person who's giving it, you know, things like that.
What's the point of becoming free of
karma? That we'll see as it comes up. Because now he's saying bhakti is the means to moksha. Because you're dealing with the mayavadis are worried about getting freedom from here. So he's dealing with those who want to become liberated. So now he's showing, you know, that this can all be done through bhakti. Because the other way is very difficult. And then from bhakti you get something even higher. So then why focus just on that? Does that make sense? It is interesting to note how the jiva becomes a mumukshu, an aspirant for moksha. In the state of disillusion, pralaya, jiva is almost like a non-intelligent material entity. At the time of creation, jiva escapes from this condition and comes back to life, being endowed with a physical body and consciousness through the compassion of Ishwara. Even as a living individual, the jiva has to pass through various stages of waking, dream, dreamless sleep, death or half-death in the form of a swoon. All these states involve some amount of suffering that the jiva has to suffer during its lifetime. What is considered to be happiness at this stage is a misnomer. According to men of philosophical wisdom, happiness is comparable to the firefly. It is highly transitory in character. One realizes through philosophic wisdom that life is nothing but suffering, dukkha, and the so-called happiness is rooted only in suffering, dukkha mula. One naturally looks forward to the permanent and real happiness. Only such individuals who develop a detachment towards worldly pleasures of evanescent character become the aspirant of moksha. Footnote 3. Bhagavad Gita 5:22, it is stated, an intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery, which are due to contact with the material senses. O son of Kunti, such pleasures have a beginning and an end, so the wise man does not delight in them. And it means, why get involved in something that's going to end? You know? It's just like if you start a meal and halfway through the meal I come and pick it up and take it away. You know, there's a good chance you won't even sit down in the first place if you know that's going to happen. It means if you think, well, maybe I didn't eat quick enough, you know? So, but whatever it is, however quickly or slowly you eat, when you're halfway through, it's to be taken away. You know? And then, you know, maybe if I put my hand out, or maybe if I, you know, eat under the table where they can't see you, you know, then, you know, but so there's all these speculations that there's some way to make it nice. But if you look at it in reality, you know, why get involved?
The living entity feels the squeeze of the material energy, and they reach out for shelter and, you know, do conditioning, and they reach for something that's temporary rather than higher.
Yes. Yeah, it's like the example is given that you're out in the middle of the ocean, you know, and you know, and a dog goes by, you know, you grab the dog's tail, that hopefully this will give you shelter and save you from the ocean. Right? So that's the problem.
It's better to call out to Vishnu on Garuda, like in the painting.
Yeah, no, that'll work better. Because the dog, unless they're not known for, you know, I mean, is there any dog you know of that swam the channel? No. Yeah, so it's not going to work. Yeah, that's the... Yeah. Because the Lord is Mukunda. He is giving. So it's through His grace that actually one even becomes interested in this. But that's by the association of saintly persons. Right? Because they understand the concept. Now, whether they have the real concept, right? That's the thing. So some are just talking about it, but don't actually endeavor for it. Just talking about it makes everybody feel good. But some endeavor for it, right? But the point is that even if, and very rare someone gets it, but even if they get it, unless it's done in connection with bhakti, it'll be temporary. You know, so then there wasn't too much of a benefit. According to Vishishta Dvaita, jivas are classified as badhas, those who are in bondage, muktas, those who are released from bondage, and nityas, those who are eternally free. That is, those who never had bondage. Right? So in other words, those who never were bound, those who become bound, you know, and become free, and those who are still bound. This struck me as if comfrey is something to do with liberation. But. All jivas are eligible for moksha, but, however, only an individual who is desirous of attaining moksha has to endeavor for it by adopting the prescribed sadhana, and he will no doubt achieve it with God's grace. God, in order to shower His grace, looks forward to a sincere desire for release on the part of the individual. Right? So here, they're looking at it that they want to be, that you're replacing, I want to be freed from the material world with, I want to therefore be engaged in your service. So they're taking it that it means that. But still, when you're talking just liberation with people on the platform of knowledge, then it's just a matter of whether someone can be freed or not. Because the Mayavadis are talking about liberation, but that means merging into Brahman. But we're talking about liberation means getting out of the material entanglement, because that's the main reason. But they don't know of anywhere else to go, and they think that will be the happiness. Rather than, you want to be happy, yes, you want to get out of here, but then you want to get into the spiritual world. Right? Does this make sense? Right. So in other words, when the living entity gives up the desire for material enjoyment, right, then that's a moment that there's a good opportunity. Because then, by the proper association, one can therefore make the endeavor for liberation. And then, getting the Lord's grace, one can be situated like that. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Bhakti is the means to moksha. Bhakti is the means, or upaya, to moksha is defined as unceasing meditation done with love on the Supreme Being. It is thus regarded as knowledge, a mental activity, in the form of love of God. It is generated by scrupulous observance of religious duties as laid down by Scripture in accordance with one's varna and ashram, along with spiritual knowledge. So for them, the varna ashram is very much part of their bhakti practice, right? Because they're trying to go to Vaikuntha, where that Vedic culture in its form as rules and regulations will be practiced. Right? You don't need, you know, so much of it to do with all the governance and setting up, and then all the things that if you don't have the opportunity to do your duty and prayaschitta, all those kind of things aren't necessary, but just the standard things aren't there. You don't have rundown houses, so you don't have to worry about not going into one unless you're a kshatriya. You know, those kinds of things. Does that make sense? But the principle of varnashram is there. So for them, is in this situation, what is your duty? Follow that nicely with devotion to the Lord. So that basically is their main element of Abhideya.
Can you repeat that last sentence?
The very last sentence.
Yes.
I don't remember the very last sentence.
Something is there. The last word was something is there.
The Abhideya.
Oh, there, meaning the Ramanujas. Generally, most of the Vaikuntha lines, then Varnashram is very much part of their practice.
Yeah, but then you said what? The other one. Take the recording. Yeah, okay. Never mind.
Means if you can't remember, how I'll remember. You know what I'm saying? Because as you get older, your memory gets less. So I remember that I've been talking. See, like when you wake up in the morning, you know you were asleep, right? You know. Yeah. You know, it was a good sleep or not a good sleep, so you can tell. It was a good talk or not a good talk. See, is that they follow, what is being brought out here is that the proper following of your duties in Varna and Ashram, right, in connection with doing it to please the Lord, meditating upon the Lord, that is their basic practice.
What's the difference between that and Vaishnava?
No, that's Vaishnava.
Oh, okay.
But this is Vaikuntha Vaishnava.
Okay.
Well, for us, Varnashram isn't actually part of Abhideya. It's just in other words, the social situation that you're in, you organize that according to Varnashram, but it's the doing your, being your duty to please the Lord, that's the bhakti. So in other words, the form of Varnashram isn't included as an integral part of bhakti. Right? But it's devotion to engage it in the Lord's service, just like you engage anything else. Does that make sense? Because for us, that the Vaikuntha mood of rules and regulations is not the medium for expression of the bhakti, but for them it is. Does that make sense? So for them, it plays a more important part. We will say it's the situation you function in. They will say it's their process. That's all. Simply because, you know, of the nature of their particular kind of devotion. You know? So in other words, it's not wrong. Rupa Goswami brings that up because sometimes this dasyam, you know, in the nine items of devotional service, dasyam by some will be translated as practicing varnashram in connection to the Lord. Right? But Rupa Goswami points out that we wouldn't translate it that way. You know, we would be functioning within that and engaging that in the Lord's service, but that you're engaging varnashram in the Lord's service isn't dasyam. It's the attitude that I'm serving the Lord, so whatever is my situation, I'm using that for the Lord. So you're just taking it to that next step. Does that make sense? Yeah. Right, so varnashram, right? It is generated by scrupulous observance of religious duties as laid down by scripture in accordance with one's varna and ashram, along with spiritual knowledge. So just varna ashram on its own is not enough. But it has to be varna ashram with spiritual knowledge. So spiritual knowledge means the knowledge of how it's connected to the Lord. Right? The performance of one's duties and rituals, karma, will have to be observed, as explained in the Gita, purely as a divine service for the pleasure of God, Bhagavat Priti, and not in any expectation of rewards thereof. Thus, this in brief is the Vishishta Dvait view of sadhana for moksha. Right? In other words, you perform your duty without a desire for the result, that will get you liberation. Right? But that you're doing it to please the Lord, that's the bhakti part. Right? So we'll say the same thing, but we won't count the varnashram aspect as part of Abhideya.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like cooking isn't the pots, right? But you need pots to cook. You know, so you could put emphasis on the pots and your facilities and all that. You know, or you could put emphasis on the cooking technique, the mood, and everything like that. Does that make sense? So it's not that one is right, one is wrong. It's just they have two different flavors. So that's why one takes you to Vaikuntha, while the other takes you to Goloka. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. So we consider following one ashram as kind of a secondary, where they consider it primary.
Yeah, they'll take it more primary. For them, it's integral because they'll be following Varnashram. It's basically you have, you know, Vaikuntha, which is the Lord's palace.
Yeah.
So it's a Kshatriya culture.
Yeah.
And so the Kshatriya culture has all this rules and regulations and formalities and everything to make it grand. And so you have a way that you know what you're doing, how to express and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's involved like that. But the emphasis, of course, is on prema, but that's very much the form.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Vrindavan, you have to have a social form, but the focus is on that intensity of love, that one-pointed love, that the other things around aren't even so important.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Though they're expert and they use them, but the focus is not on them. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like the guy gets in the car, you know, checks the links, this, that, checks all the things, does all of this, you know, and then drives down the road. Someone else is a good driver, just gets in and automatically does all those and drives. So he's not focused on it, but he uses it. You know what I'm saying? So it's a slightly different flavor. You know, one's very formal and one is not. Yes?
Can you tell right now who's going to be which one?
Who meaning as an individual?
As the devotees, which, can you tell in this life what, which one?
Means life meaning the whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, basically. It means it's just whatever's the attraction. But for the Gaudiyas, then Raghunath Das recommends not becoming attracted to Vaikuntha. Because the point is the opportunity to function in Vrindavan and Krishna's pastimes is being made available. So why not take that? But there are those who, no, they're very much, prefer the Vaikuntha route, so then that's there. So we don't have a problem with it. Just we wouldn't be interested in it. We wouldn't cultivate that.
What do you mean we?
As in white man?
the game console from Japan?
Or the game console for Japan? I think we've already been through this, haven't we?
Yes,
sir. Yeah, we went through this yesterday, yes. The definition of we.
We are the one. Because of my ignorance.
No, we meaning generally means the Gaudiya Vaishnavas.
Okay.
Because this is Vishishta Dvaita, so this is Sri Vaishnavas. All we're doing is comparing within Vaishnavism. It means this study is comparing within Vaishnavism the various Vaishnav schools to each other, right?
Oh, okay.
You understand?
Yes.
But at the same time, there's always, because of the need, they themselves are giving arguments against, atheism. You know, Shankara and other such atheistic schools. So that's one common thing, is all of them will be defeating Mayavadis. But at the same time, as then you can see their particular approach, how they're going to defeat the Mayavadis, then is slightly different. So therefore, which aspects of the philosophy they emphasize is different. Right? So here, talking about becoming freed from the material world and this and that, we don't talk about it so much, right? Because the thing is they're trying to get to prema, right? And so pure devotion in prema. But we're trying to get to pure unalloyed devotion, right? Because in Braj, then these forms aren't what's important. What's important is the exchange, right? So for them, the form is important because it's the medium through which you're going to explain something, or it means express. So they give it basically the same weight. Well, we don't, because it's more the mood, like that. So that aspect is why then we won't emphasize it so much while they will, right? But then you have a very nice form. For in us, then someone actually is mature and understands, they follow the form because you have to use some form, but their focus is not on it. So the tendency is whatever we focus on, then that we take as important. What we don't focus on is not important. Right? So then here to see that the form goes nicely, then they're given that these two are together. Right? You can't cook without the pot and spoon. So they're given, the cooking technique and the utensils are given equal weight. Well, our point is that it's the mood, because they're doing it in on reverence and servitorship in Vaikuntha. So they're going to use a very nice pot, very nice spoon, very nice, you know, like that. You understand? But for us, it's the cooking itself. So therefore, we'll arrange whatever is the nicest that's available. But if we have to use an old, you know, tin can, we'll do it. You know, it won't be considered by us something less. Because if the mood is full, then it's accomplished.
I guess I'm just asking because I like sometimes I like rules a lot and nice spoons and stuff. So
nice spoons.
Yeah. Okay. Not a nice spoon, but your example.
Okay. Not specifically spoon.
Not specifically. Yes, okay. Spoons. Well, spoons are okay. So I'm kind of scared. Like, is that going to go away? Or should I go and join the other guys?
No, it'll go away. And even if it doesn't, you'll get to wherever they're going to get much quicker.
Okay.
So don't worry about it. Just stay over here. You'll do fine. Okay, so they're using the form of varnashram, being done for the pleasure of the Lord. That's right. So that's the bhakti. At the same time, is that performance of that those duties in varnashram are done without desire for the result. So nice karma. So by definition, then that will give you moksha. But at the same time, is the reason it's being offered in devotion is because you're not desiring it for yourself. Right? Does that make sense? So they'll kind of keep it in that kind of mode. While we will emphasize more that you're doing it for the Lord, therefore automatically you're not doing it for yourself. Does that make sense? Because then it's more on the bhav, while the other is you're appreciating that the person is selflessly working and these kind of things, all these nice qualities, because these are all the things you can talk about in court. You know, it means court meaning the Lord's court, you know, where the Lord sits, you know, in his throne, in his palace. And so these are all things that can be appreciated and discussed and like that. The justification for introducing the concept of bhakti is provided on the authority of a specific passage in the Mundaka Upanishad and three relevant verses in the Bhagavad Gita. Right? Because you're taking the Mayavadi, you're taking it from a bogus form of monism into an actual proper form of monism. Pointing out the proper form of monism is that the jiva is still an individual and the Lord is the supreme individual. And so it's a relationship, you know, the relationship is based there. Now, if you have that interest in that kind of knowledge and work without a desire for fruit or result, you will be liberated, therefore. But you still maintain an eternal position in relationship with the Lord. So that means then that that relationship, that situation of bhakti, that's the actual point of goal of liberation, right? So then the next step is to take that. Therefore, then where does the bhakti element come in? Because even if they'll agree on, okay, the moksha element, okay, there's a difference there. You don't merge with the Lord. You remain individual. You know, it's by the Lord's grace rather than just your own endeavors. You know, all these different things. But still, why bhakti? Right, because you see these other schools in the darshan, that when they get liberation, there's no connection with the Lord. They just kind of sink into this state of, you know, non-conscious existence. Right? Somehow, I don't know why that's considered good. But
so funny.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to be really tired to, you know, be interested in that.
And they go about it in such different ways, and somehow they all end there.
Because it's still Maya.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how you know, it's just like you have so many varieties of food, but it all ends up in the mouth, right? You know, so it's It's the modes of nature. She just, because the point is if there was one system for everybody, then people would get bored, you know, or their false ego, well, everybody else is doing that, I have to do different. I knew this one devotee, he was so good at dressing like that, you know, I mean, he was from Paris, and, you know, from...
Naturally.
How do you say that? Champs.
Champs-Élysées.
So he was from there. It means they had they lived there. That was where their house was, you know. And so, you know, they're very wealthy, very cultured, you know, that kind of, you know. And so he knew how to dress, you know, how to wear the cloth, how to do everything and that. But if anybody else copied him, he'd immediately change it. You know, because then it's become common. Because the other guys couldn't dress. Means if they could dress like him, then you don't mind. You know, it's like all the guys down at the club in their tweed suits. It's all right. But even though the garbage man's wearing a tweed suit, then you go buy something else. So it was really funny like that. You know, so therefore, if there was only one system, then everybody would not be interested. Because some would become, we've done that, we're bored of that, or that, you know, we're better than that, or something else. So you have so many things that actually do exactly the same thing. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the whole idea, is that variety, then, you know, why? It means you have the little corner store there, right? Everything you need, you can get in that little store, right? It's right down from your house. It's got everything that you need. But the supermarket has, you know, 10, 20 times more than what you need, things you've never even thought of you need, right? And then that's, oh, wow, you know, like that. So that's just what Maya does. She creates variety because she's feminine, so she creates a variety. But she's creating the variety based on our idea that we're the lord and enjoyer of variety. So she simply presents what's there, you know. And so then, as long as there's some variety, then we accept it. Right? Does that make sense? Just like, let's say, Okay, the justification for introducing the concept of bhakti is provided on the authority of a specific passage in the Mundaka Upanishad. Remember, they're presenting it to the public. So they'll be asking, so why are you presenting bhakti? Mm. Right? Within themselves, there's no question that it's not always about bhakti. Okay. A specific passage of the Mundaka Upanishad and three relevant verses in the Bhagavad Gita. The Upanishadic text says, Mundaka Upanishad 3.2.3, Nayam atma pravachanena labhyo na medhaya na bahuna shutena. Yam evaisha vrinute tena labhya atma vrinute tanum swam. This self, Brahman, cannot be attained by the study of the Vedas, nor by meditation, nor through much hearing. He is to be attained only by one who the self chooses. To such a person, the self reveals the nature. So it's, in other words, by no other method can you actually know about the Supreme Lord except by His own grace. This verse and another in the Gita, 11:53-54, seem to contradict the statement in the Brihat Aranyaka Upanishad, 6:5-6. Atma va. Va are drashtavya shrotavyo mantavyo nididhyasi tatvya, which says that the process of self-realization implies shravanam, hearing, manana, reflection, and nididhyasana, contemplation. Okay, so here's the one for where that Upanishadic system of knowledge is from. The explanation is that what is negated in the particular verse in Mundaka Upanishad is mere shravana, etc., devoid of intense bhakti. Oh, devoid of intense bhakti is of no use for God realization. So shravana, manana, nididhyasana is devoid of bhakti, then doesn't have any meaning. So in other words, the other one, it's not by that, but by the Lord reveals Himself. So then we say, okay, we don't have to do all that. But it's your sincere endeavor to do those things to know Him by which He's pleased. Does that make sense? Otherwise, if you say, oh, it's just pleasing the person, means the point is it's not the gift, it's pleasing the person. So I want to please the person, so I don't really need the gift. So now what are you going to do to please the person? Does that make sense?
Mine.
But still, you're doing something. You mean come with the gift and all that?
If you want to please them, it's very risky.
No, that works in the, that means, I think in the 80s, that works in the discos. But, you know, like that, yeah. So the point is no.
Yeah. Man in the box.
Thereby, it is only the unconditional, deep-rooted love for God that serves as a means to know God in His true form, to have this deep vision, to have this vision, and eventually to attain Him. This means that divine vision is possible only through God's grace. In order to earn it, one has to be deeply devoted to God. So we'll say the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Can I just ask? I've just got a question going on from yesterday. That's got to do with divine vision, I guess.
Okay.
So
you want to know if when you have divine vision, if your eyes go a little bit blue or something, like light up a little bit, swirl.
No, like that. It's about that, the one that I asked.
I think swirling is a scary movie.
It's the one that about how you can see Krishna in every situation.
Yes.
So I was just walking and I decided that I was going to, you know, okay, next thing that I see, I'm going to think of how that's related to Krishna. And I was walking close to the side of the path and there was, excuse me for this, but there was a bit of dog poo on the side.
I knew that. That's what you're going to see. Just as you were going along, I figured she's going to see the dog. Yeah, yeah, okay. I mean, there's so many things on the path.
Right? And then there was a dog walking the opposite direction to me.
So which one did you decide to connect to the Lord?
Well, the situation was that I was walking past the dog poo, and the dog was, and I was in the way of the dog.
And the dog was walking past you.
Yeah, and the dog noticed the dog poo, wanted to smell it, but he was waiting eagerly till I walked past. And that was the situation that I didn't know.
How to connect that to Krishna.
So I asked a few devotees, and one devotee said that when she sees things like that, she thinks, I feel grateful that I'm not, you know, in that body of a dog that is behaving like that. And then another devotee said that, you know, how in the Gita it says that I am the taste of water, and that's some stuff. It's like I am the smell of dog poo to it.
To a dog, right? Yeah. I mean, any of those is there, but the point is the material world is not a nice place. It's compared to a toilet, you know. So then, but the point is the living entity is still attached to that. That's the sad part. So in other words, the one is what the material world actually has to offer, and the sad thing is people are actually attached to what's being offered.
So I could think of Krishna in that situation in any way that I can come up.
Yeah, yeah. It means Krishna is unlimited, so there's so many connections and attributes you can go from. So whichever one, you know, comes up or which is relevant for the particular context in which you're trying to do that.
I just felt like that was a bit of, like it was too speculative.
No, it's not. Point is everything can be connected. But, you know, generally the tendency is we always find the most extreme kind of things.
It wasn't me, it was Krishna.
Oh, okay. Oh. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Now,
yes.
I was just thinking of the pastime that Indra becomes a pig.
Oh, yeah, he becomes a pig. And he also likes. So he's. Okay. Thus, the terms such as jnana, upasana, dhyana, dhruvanu smriti, etc., which are used in the Upanishads as means of moksha, are to be understood to mean the same thing. Otherwise, it would amount to the admission of different means of moksha. If the means be different, the goal to be achieved would also be different. Actually, the goal is the same for all, and hence the means should all be the same. Therefore, it is concluded that all these terms, though they appear to have different meanings, should have the meaning of the specific term bhakti, according to Mimamsa principal interpretation. Right? In other words, a particular activity gets a particular result. So then, if you're giving all these different things and they're actually different systems, then they would give different results. But if we're saying that they're all supposed to give moksha, that means they actually have to all be the same. Different details, but the same principle, in that they're all connected with bhakti. So in other words, devotional service is to be performed. And within devotional service, you have the proper knowledge of the Lord, you do the proper authorized worship of the Lord, you meditate upon the Lord, you're fixed in different things connected to the Lord. Does that make sense? Right? So then you can understand it's actually bhakti is the common ground. And these are just various aspects of bhakti. Right? Does that make sense? Because if I say cutting vegetables, that doesn't mean cooking's going on. Marketing, it doesn't mean cooking's going on. Right? Making a menu doesn't mean cooking's going on. Eating, it doesn't mean cooking's going on. Right? Washing dishes, cleaning the kitchen, you know, buying utensils for the kitchen, it doesn't mean cooking's going on. But if you say cooking, you have to do all the others. So cooking is the one thing that holds all those together. So bhakti is the one thing that holds all those together. Because any process there is, it's there in bhakti. Right? So it's the one thing that unites all endeavor, all ritual, all philosophy, all God, you know, all endeavor.
And you can't say that bhakti is necessarily in any one of them.
Yeah, but at the same time, as they themselves aren't bhakti,
yeah,
but they can be part of bhakti.
So bhakti is superior to all.
Yeah, bhakti is superior. If gone alone. Okay, so the Mimamsa principle of interpretation. I think at one time we get to that. If jnana alone is considered as the sole means to moksha, as the impersonalists contend, all the Upanishadic texts referring to upasana become meaningless. Bhakti as an upaya for moksha is described in Gita as bhakti yoga. It is a lifelong, rigorous discipline involving the acquisition of spiritual knowledge, development of certain ethical virtues, and observance of religious duties as laid down by sacred texts. According to, yeah, so if jnana is the only thing, then all the other things that are mentioned in relationship to the Lord, then, I mean, to moksha, then become meaningless. Right, because they're just saying it's only jnana, but then why are they taking sannyas? That's varnashram, you know. So you know, so many things there. They're sitting there worshiping, doing their worship of their, you know, Shiva, Linga, or Maya, or something like that. But then that's upasana. So how is all that, you know? So in other words, all those are connected. The only thing that actually connects those all is bhakti, because bhakti includes all of the systems, while the other systems only include themselves. Right? It means you can force the others into it, but it's not natural. According to Vishishta Dvaita, bhakti yoga is to be preceded by the practice of karma yoga and jnana yoga referred to in the Bhagavad Gita. Karma yoga emphasized the disinterested performance of action, karma, such as sacrifice, yajna, charity, dana, and austerity, tapas, as divine service without any expectation of rewards thereof. Jnana yoga signifies constant meditation upon Atma, the individual self, with control of the mind and senses. The two are interrelated, and the aim of both is self-realization. Atma valokana. Both these subserve bhakti, and as such, they are subsidiary means to bhakti yoga, which is the direct means to self-realization. So in other words, these elements, because we're involved in the material world, by performing all our activities, our duties, without a desire for the result for ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Just because that's what we're supposed to do, then that becomes, how do you say? One becomes purified, one becomes elevated, right? The natural thing that's just knowledge. Then one is able to focus on knowledge of the self and always to be absorbed in that, you know, to avoid things that are not beneficial for seeing in that way. Just like when you're doing karma, you stay away from, you know, bad karma. You just perform good, right? So the thing is then bhakti, we're bringing it to bhakti, but bhakti means it's fully focused on the Lord, right? So we'll look at it as that, therefore, karma yoga, jnana yoga, also means bhakti yoga. It just means engaging the activities in the Lord's service and having proper knowledge connected to the Lord. Does that make sense? But it's natural that one will start with the activities itself, with the body. Then the intelligence in the mind will become involved. Then that meditation upon the Lord. Right? And then it'll be just fixed that it's just that devotion that's the prominent, not these other elements. Yes.
In this morning's Bhagavatam class, the speaker was talking about, like, similar to what was there, about how to perform pure devotional service, not like, you know, the second meaning of the word, like not like a pure unalloyed devotee, but like just without, you know, you've still got maybe material desires, but the intention is pure. You don't need to be purified, like you don't need any other qualifications other than just perform service, just do it. And I was wondering, if you're not purified, then how can you trust that you're making the right? How can you trust that you're reading what Krishna is telling you correctly?
Because you're following the direction of higher authorities. You know what I'm saying? That's why purports are there. If it was just the Gita shlokas, we might interpret in so many ways. That's why the purports are there. Right? That's why tradition is there. That's why these things are there. Right? Because then you know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We specifically never emphasize that karma and jnana should be first bhakti.
But here's, but he's talking about jnana, karma yoga, jnana yoga. You know, so it's the same. We'll also say it's the yoga ladder. The one will naturally, because we're taking bhakti, meaning the focus is just that devotion. But at the same time, is bhakti includes the activities of the body, mind, and words engaged in the Lord's service. So it would include the activities of karma, the activities of jnana, the activities of jnana. Right? But at the same time, is for someone who's practicing bhakti but is not on the platform of actual pure bhakti, right? Then their focus will be on the activity or the knowledge. Right? But they're doing it for Krishna, so that's why it's karma yoga, jnana yoga. So it's part of bhakti. It's an anga of bhakti. But at the same time, it's the doing it for Krishna that makes it devotion. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah.
So, just to clarify, so the perfection of that is to be doing the activity as devotional service with, like, with the growth of a feeling of love for Krishna, or are you doing it? Meditating on that?
Yeah, that's what you're trying to get. But if not, at least it's not for you, and that the result will be given to Krishna.
Yeah.
The two are interrelated, and the aim of both is self-realization, atma-valokana. Both these subserve bhakti, and as such they are subsidiary means to bhakti yoga, which is the direct means to God realization. So the direct point is that devotion to God. That's the direct method. That you're engaging these other things to express that, those things are secondary. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The four main requirements or adhikara for bhakti yoga are: 1. A clear philosophic knowledge of the realms of karma, jnana, and bhakti. 2. The will to rigorously undergo the discipline in due order. 3. The shastra qualification of birth as an essential aid to bhakti. And four, sattvic patience, to endure the prarabdha karma till it is exhausted or expiated. Footnote four. Same idea is expressed in the Srimad Bhagavatam 10.14.8. My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation. It has become his rightful claim. Stick around.
So we have to allow them their temples?
It depends. Some of them allow, some of them don't. Because of this element of Shastra qualification of birth. But at the same time as Ramanuja, there's a whole class of people who weren't from, you know, proper families. And he made them all into devotees, and they're all part of the festivals. They have a certain title and everything like that. So those who get too caught up on the, you know, that Brahman and all that kind of stuff, then when that's pointed out, they have to agree. Like that. You know, just like in Puri, you have the Sabaras. So they can't get too bent out of shape, but they still do. Because you know, they're only around for 2 weeks, right? You know, that means 50 more weeks of the year. Okay, yeah. So these things here. But you could also say Shastra qualification of birth is an essential aid to bhakti. Then you could also look at it as that the qualifications of birth you will use according to Shastra in the Lord's service. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So whatever your conditioned nature is, then, however, that's recommended by Shastra to engage, that you use. Mm. You know what I'm saying? So that's how we'll apply that one. Because the point is your conditioning is what you're born into. Right? You know, and then what you, by association, develop it from there. Mm.
But Sris are also in Europe and America, right?
They are now. Yeah. But before they weren't.
No, but...
But, I mean, Europe, you haven't really crossed the ocean.
Right. That's true.
But America, you can't say that it's, you know, you have to cross one way or the other to get to America. So.
What about the fourth one? The
prarabdha karma. Yeah, it means, in other words, sattvic patience to endure the prarabdha karma till it's exhausted or expiated. Prarabdha karma just means the reactions to your activities. Prarabdha means what's manifest.
Means when your prarabdha karma is finished, you're not here.
Basically.
You're waiting for that without practicing?
No, but with sattvic patience.
So they do practice while waiting with sattvic patience?
Yes.
Okay. And then the second one, what's so rigorous? Or their practice is different?
No, it's just that they do it a lot more than we do.
And they?
Our rituals are more complicated than theirs, but we do them once. Theirs are really simple, but they do them over and over and over and over and over again.
Every day?
Every day.
And the third one is the same.
Yeah, so it means you get up in the morning, you have your bath, you're chanting all the mantras, you sit down, you do all your achmans, you chant your gayatri, you do the avahana, the gayatri, you do all the different things, you sit in the proper thing, proper direction, doing all the things like that. Then you go, you do your puja, you're doing that for hours. After that, you take the remnants of the Lord, then you go back and do other things like that. And then, so they just like, you know, in other words, if it was a festival day, every day, that's their normal sadhana.
No women are into it?
Means they're doing whatever they're doing in the house. You know, they may be involved in the home worship, but they're not in the temple worship. Because the temple worship is very, very elaborate in that way. It's just not attractive.
So it's like this external thing that, wow, I'm really spiritual now because I'm doing all these rituals.
No, it's just because in Vaikuntha, that's how it works. It works in that kind of thing, and there is all those festivals throughout the day. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Lord goes to take a bath, you know, they get out the umbrella and the instruments and take them, and that's the whole thing, and take off all all the, whatever was there from the last thing, you know, and then, you know, all the worship and everything, then the bathing and all that, and then he's dressed and all that, and then all the worship is done there for that asana. Means you get for greeting him at the asana, and then when you finish with that worship, then like that, then he'll go to the next asana. Mm. Right? Then the palanquin will go to where he's going to eat, but then you take off everything that was from the last one and receive him there at that one, and then eat, and then you worship him after that there. So everything's like that. Right? Well, we'll just, you know, bathe like that, take him up, dry him like that, put him down, you know, dress him, and then offer the boga. But that was, those are three different asanas. Mm. Like that. So at each asana, then you go through the 10 items. And then whatever's the one of that particular one. You know, so they're just over and over and over and over again.
So their main point is deity worship?
Okay. Yeah, that's very, the Pancharatra. Well, for the Shris then, Vedanta Sutra, Pancharatra, and the songs of the Acharyas. That's their three main focuses. Yeah, they're the all, they have the all ones. The Divya Prabandha.
And what they preach then? If they go to the West, for example?
I have no idea. Like that. No, people get into it. People don't mind being that ritualistic, you know, as long as then that's the form. See, the problem with us is that we use the forms of ritual, but it's the emphasis is not on the ritual. So therefore, the tendency is if it's not that, then why use it at all? That's the mistake. So that's why Rupa Goswami talks about Niyamagraha. Either you think, no, it's all about the ritual, or we don't even need the ritual at all. Mm. No, it's about devotion to the Lord, using the ritual in a balanced way that's appropriate for the situation.
This is a general tendency, no matter what we're talking about. If it's not the primary, we have a tendency to throw it out.
Yeah, we throw it out. Well, that's what you see. It's either, it's like, you know, what about them around? Yeah. You know, like this, it's all this. Or, yeah, we don't care at all. And anybody can do anything. No, it's the proper balance. It's just because it's not primary doesn't mean that it's not important. But you have to be able to tell the difference between what's primary and what's secondary. But if you can't do that, then the whole discussion, you know, like it goes on this morning about the administrative element, is the Brahmins are primary, the Kshatriyas are secondary. They're looking at their primary, and then you have to have Brahmins on the side, and there's going to be Vaishyas making money so you can take tax. And they need Shudras to do all the work, you know. But no, the Brahmins are the primary, the Kshatriyas is secondary. Means if you don't have the spiritual knowledge and training and example, there's no use to society, right? Then to run a society, you have to have administration to create protection and that so everybody can perform their duties. Now, in that, you have to be able to maintain yourself. Therefore, there must be money, right? And then all that requires work. All those three areas require work, therefore they're Shudras, right? You know, so that way, then everybody is taken care of. So the Brahma Kshatriyas Vaishyas take care of the Shudras, right? They all give in charity to the Brahmins, right? Does that make sense? The Vaishyas pay tax to the Kshatriyas. You know, so it's all, everybody gets taken care of.
Yeah. Kshatriyas protect so economy can go on.
Yeah, if there's no protection, there's no economy. That's why Vaishyas are so bejiggity about justice and morality. Because without that, there's no economics. That makes sense? Yeah. According to Vishishtadvaita, although bhakti is a desirable means to mukti, it is not easily practiced in this age of Kali Yuga owing to its arduousness. But Shastra, in its infinite mercy to the erring humanity, guarantees God to all jivas irrespective to their status and situation in life. It is provided for the weak and infirm in an alternate path to mukti known as prapatti, or the absolute self-surrender to God. But generally they give this, is the weak and infirm means when you're too old to do all this. Because prapatti is when you're old. Right? The only prerequisite for prapatti is the change of heart or contrition on the part of the mumukshu, and his absolute confidence in the saving grace of God. It is the essence of the religion of prapatti that the Lord of grace seeks the prapanna and draws him to himself. means the one who surrenders. Like the act has a summary effect as it destroys even Prarabdha karma. The supreme merit of Prapatti lies in the universality of its appeal to all castes and classes, the guarantee of salvation to all jivas who cannot follow the arduous path of bhakti. But an interesting point, do you notice that this last paragraph sounds that while we preach, you know, from the beginning. So for us, this is how we, you know, while they're sitting there eating their halava, this is what we talk to them. But for the Shris, this is when you're old and have finished all your, you know, your grihastha duties and all that, and vanaprastha, then you take this up. Like if you're preaching with the Shris, don't use the verse sarvadharmam parityaja. Because for them, that's a secret mantra of Prapatti. So it's only said in private and explained like that. So that's a very advanced stage for them. But for us, what if they consider the advanced stage, we consider, you know, where you walk in the door. Yeah. That's where we start. Yeah, so that's, you'll see that's also a difference. So that makes it that it's much more open and anybody can be involved. So everybody can be involved in that. So the intelligent person is already doing that from the very beginning. But otherwise, at least then at the end they're doing it. But we try to affect this from the beginning. Right, you know, the standard, just surrender, Prabhu.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so. Yeah, so, like that.
Or is they're changing from baby monkey to ketan mode towards the end?
Yeah. But I'm not sure what is his. It doesn't bring that out. What is his? What is that? What they say is the. That's an important element that they bring out.
That's from that tradition, right?
Like, yeah, means you have those two. Because ours is a combination. Because most are the cat or the mouse. No? Monkey. Cat or the monkey. Yeah. That's the cat and mouse. It's a different one. Like that. So the cat, he's just carried.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to do it. He just has to be submissive.
Yeah.
And the monkey has to hold on. But, you know, all support is there if you hold on. You know, it's not that there's neglect, it's just you hold on and they'll, you know, like that. But how we explain it is like the rope in the well. Someone's in the well, you throw the rope. So they have to hold on to the rope like the monkey, but you're pulling the rope like the cat. So it's that combination.
Yeah.
So, thank you. Oh. It's just half a page.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki Jai Samaveda Bhaktivinoda ki
Jai
Nityananda Gaura ki Last night, all those ladies came, thought it was going to be Chai Vidarna.
Yeah.
Did everybody survive this morning?
Yeah.
Yeah? Was it too difficult? I mean, not now, the first class.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't... I missed something
interesting. It's just, you know. How on a discussion of, you know, what you say, yeah, then you get into how, you know, the ISKCON society is managed. You know, it's one of those.